Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the cuisine and culture of a destination. Part travel show, part current affairs, Native recognizes the fact that food culture is everywhere and takes the opportunity to examine the nuances that help define a place by using the eyes, ears, and taste buds of farmers, chefs, journalists, and the like. This week, I am joined by Aldo Sam of La Bernardin and the new Sambar to discuss his native Austria. So, hi, Aldo. Welcome to Heritage.
Hello. How are you?
Wonderful. So, you have been celebrated as one of the leading wine professionals in the world, including being named Best Sommelier in the world by World Sommelier Association in 2008. So, I would be remiss not to talk about wine while I have you here, and we're going to get to that in a little bit, but let's start out by diving into your past first a little bit, and then learning about Austria along the way. Sound good?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, where are you from in Austria?
I grew up in Innsbruck, in the area of Innsbruck.
Where is that kind of in the country?
Innsbruck is basically when you I think Munich is more known here. You just travel south about an hour and a half by car.
And what does, if you could generalize a little bit, what does Austria's topography and climate really look and feel like?
It's very mixed. I mean, if you go to Innsbruck, it's the best way to describe it. It's like if you go to the Rocky Mountains. If you go to Aspen, you know, you get a similar feel of that area. Just you're in the middle of the Alps there, so it's the mountains are really rocky. But it's a very green, very, very pure country. If you go towards the eastern side where Vienna is, it's more flat. And it's also really, really green there. Austrians are very, very protective towards their nature. Also farming, you know, we grew up to 75% is biodynamic or organic farmed. But we don't mention that as hard. It's just something very normal to us.
And so how does that play out on the influence of the food, Austrian food?
We love to eat and we love to drink. We are known for that. We are known for hospitality on top of it. That's a long, long history with us, you know, tourism especially. I mean, if you go a little bit further west of Innsbruck to the Arlberg region, where basically skiing was invented and basically brought all over the world, tourism played their major role because there was no other income other than farming or tourism. So that's basically in our veins, in our blood.
Are those still the two primary markets, like tourism and farming, agriculture?
It's in the western part, so even in some southern parts, it's certainly tourism plays a major, major role.
Okay, and so I do just want to keep like digging into the food a little bit. If I were to go to Austria, say for the holidays, maybe sometime soon, and I wanted to eat like an Austrian would eat, what would I have for each of the primary meals, breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Or do they have a different meal structure?
It depends. I mean, if I go to Austria, I eat certain things because I grew up with them. They might be not the most necessarily the most polished things, but they have such a depth in flavor, have such a precision in flavor. And you know, it's like when you grow up with some things, you memorize that. Mm-hmm. I definitely would go, for the holiday, I would definitely go either to Salzburg or to Vienna. Even though most Americans know exactly those two cities, Vienna has just for me, it's 1.8 million citizen. It's large, but still charming enough. It didn't lost a soul. If you care for a little bit of art, music, history, or even architecture, Vienna, you'll be in heaven there. And you still have a little bit laid back lifestyle there. All these little coffee houses. But it's different than a coffee house here.
You know, how is it different?
We love to sit down enjoy our, you know, it's over there you call it mélange. Here you call it very often cappuccino, or for an hour, little espresso. We sit down, maybe read a newspaper. It's very common that if you go to the coffee houses, like you sit down, read a newspaper. They have a broad selection of newspapers. You read that, maybe have a little bit of a kipfel, meaning kipfel is kind of like a croissant in this way, like a brioche style. And enjoy that, and then you move on with your day.
So you don't go take your laptop and sit there for hours and work on your startup company or
no.
<There's> like all the Brooklyn coffee shops.
Well, you kind of paint black and white, but it's a little different culture, you know. And that's for me the most interesting part, especially also living in New York. You're influenced by so many different cultures in one little spot. By going over there, obviously, I mean, Vienna was a melting pot 150 years ago when the monarchy still was intact, had certain similarities towards New York. Because there were so many different ethnical cultures here, which was, of course, brought its positive sides, but also its conflicts. Mm. And therefore, Vienna has so much also food influences in there. You know, if you go just to certain dishes for Christmas, for instance, for me, the cookies, the Christmas cookies, the vanilla kipfel, it's for me a must.
What is that?
It's kipfel is basically like a little croissant. It's made of a dough with a lot of nuts and butter, and you bake it. They're very, very morbid and soft, and it has just a little vanilla powder sugar on.
And so it's a little bit like the croissant texture. But
no, it's a little bit more tougher texture,
okay,
because you have the majority is of hazelnuts.
Oh, okay.
And it's just something I grew up as a child, you know, and my mom was always most upset when she baked because by the time the cookies were ready,
you ate them all.
They were gone.
So let's get a little deeper into that. That's one great example. What are there some other comfort foods that maybe you craved like when you were a kid if you weren't like feeling well, or maybe things that you crave now, like as soon as you go home, as soon as you visit Austria, what do you want?
Well, the first thing when I go home is having a sausage, especially those Viennese sausages. I find it a hard time to find here a good sausage because very often a sausage to me has to be made with pork. And because it has such a juiciness and has also a little different fat component. If you have beef, Viennese, sausage or turkey, they just taste bland. There's not
enough fat.
Not only the fat part, it's also the spike in flavors. That's not there. It's sort of bland in flavors. That's one thing I have immediately, and I crave for that.
How often do you get to go back?
This year I went only once. Normally go up to twice over there, three times depending.
Yeah, because you've got some projects going on there, which we'll get to in a
exactly.
minute. You gotta go. You know, you gotta check in.
I mean, 2 years ago, I was five times over there, but.
So you mentioned the Christmas cookies. I want to talk, since it is the season, I want to talk about Austrian and food holidays and that relationship. So, what is the biggest food holiday in Austria? Is it Christmas? Is there another national kind of? You know, here we have something like 4th of July. A lot of countries have a national day of sorts.
Christmas is certainly a big one. Easter is certainly a big one. And I would leave it basically there.
Mm-hmm.
But still, Austrians love to eat
in all the time,
any occasion.
So what's?
But you take time. You know, you sit together with your friends, and there's even a term which doesn't exist in English called Gemütlichkeit. You know, when you sit together with your friends, you basically take off yourself. Put away your cell phones, you just chit-chat, have a great time, you drink, you eat for hours, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, and, you know.
Sounds like heaven.
That's basically, yeah, it's a sort of comforting getting together, you know.
So if I were to have a traditional Austrian Christmas meal, what would that look like? What would I be eating?
You know, I was afraid they would ask me that because the traditions are very, very different there. Some people have a goose. Mm-hmm. A goose is obviously a little richer and fattier. That's not everybody's cup of tea. I never was really crazy about it. Some people have a carp, you know, that fish. Mm-hmm. Also a little bit fattier in its way. Some people go on a duck. I ironically grew up with fondue because my parents came closer to Switzerland. So we had always fondue. This was always the biggest part for us. So it totally varies.
Well, there's something about really having those richer dishes around the holidays. There's this, you know, it's the time of year, you don't have them all the time. It makes them special.
I mean, we had always a lot of snow. I mean, when I grew up in my childhood, you know, 3 feet, 4 feet of snow during Christmas was something totally normal. Now with global warming, it changes. I mean, they're still waiting over there. They haven't seen snow. It's kind of a little desperate.
Running out of time.
Well, ski season started normally already, but they go skiing on the glaciers right now. But the tourism areas are not super happy this winter.
Well, let's move on a little bit. What are there any things that people would be surprised to find out about Austrian food? If they went over there and they'd be surprised to see maybe influences that you wouldn't expect, or the way something that's familiar, but the way that Austrians use it's different.
You know, until 4 years ago, I would have been not able to respond to that question. I took a group of sommeliers with me to discover Austria and made a little power trip through it too. And by just watching them, I experienced something interesting. They had no expectation. I mean, look, what do people know here about Austrian food? They know Wiener Schnitzel. They know maybe some sweets. They know, if they did a little research, that the coffee house culture or the coffee culture is basically from Vienna as well. Or back in Austria, I mean, Johann Kolschitzky from the Blue Bottle, the very successful coffee chain here, the Blaue Flasche, basically was the first coffee brewery. So that's basically it. When I took all the guys over there, we went to... I put always a mixed program together when I go to traveling wine, because when you travel wine, you get, at one point, it gets only redundant. You go from one winery, from one cellar to the next, and even as an experienced person, at one point, you get... I mean, it's getting fatigue. But Austria has such a wealth in terms of cultural components. So I went with them to saw a special tour. We got a special tour through two different museums, just focused on the early Klimt drawings. That was one part. Another part I did with them, we went to a farming area, and one of them was he's known as the Tomato Pope, Stekovic.
Why is that so? Why is he known as the Tomato Pope?
Because he breeds and clones a lot. He makes up 800 different chili types. But he went with us into an interesting observation there. He went with us into a strawberry field and said, now we're basically in the field which produces the best strawberry in the world. Now, everybody had, of course, a smile on their face, because that's a pretty bold statement with not having anything behind it. So then he started explaining.
Was it the right season? Was it strawberry season?
Yes.
Okay.
And... again, those sommeliers, they're all top of the line from America, really top of the line. And everybody smiled, and so he started explaining. I said, look, this clone, and he explained exactly how basically strawberry grows, where it gets the roots and everything. And he said it's only a female strawberry, and the name is called Mietze Schindler, because it's named after Maria and Schindler, and he basically discovered that clone only on her graveyard in Dresden, up in Germany. And it's a female strawberry, which means the seeds are inside. After you harvest, you have to consume it immediately or produce it into jam. You cannot stay for a whole day. Mm. And then he let us try, and then everybody agreed 100% on it. That's the best strawberry.
Everyone agreed. Best strawberry in the world.
Uniformly. One actually made a comment on it and said, I noticed until now I ate only second-class strawberries.
Well, and that sounds like something, like if I were to go to Austria during the season, can you get them? Are they readily available, or it's only from him?
It's in a specific area there, okay. In the Burgenland, in the eastern part, basically, that area you find them. I've never seen them anywhere else. But you find those pockets. Look, that's the interesting part. We went also in different restaurants, you know, from high-end to just regular, just to show them also, look, traditional versus, you know, modern Austrian cuisine.
Excellent. Well, I do want to talk a little bit more about that regionality and more about the dining scene in Austria. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll be learning more about Austria with Aldo Sam.
Let's do it.
You are listening to Youngblood by The Hollows.
Boy, you gotta go. The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
All right, we are back. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and you're listening to Native on Heritage Radio. And today I'm talking to Aldo Sam of Le Bernardin and Sambar all about Austrian culture and cuisine. So I want to continue with a little conversation we were just having over the break. I mentioned to you that I actually haven't been to Austria, but I've been to Germany. So of course, in my mind, I understand that they're completely separate, but the closest touchstone I have is Germany, as far as the way the landscape looks, how I think about the food. So... And you kind of shared with me, no, I'm completely wrong. And
No, I didn't say that harsh.
but maybe you could explain to me a little bit your feelings about that.
Yeah, well, look, I hear that all the time. You know, German and Austrians are totally the same. I used to be offended, not anymore. I'm European, that's the way how I see it, and that's what it is, that's the way how I feel. No, it's... You know, Europe has so many small different countries, you know. America is so large, yet it's one country, it's on its own. But just to explain that, it's just like comparing Americans to Canadians. They might speak the same language, you know, but they have so many different cultural backgrounds, and they express themselves differently, and...
So it's like states, because most European countries are so small. So that would be like saying that people from Texas are the same as people from California. It doesn't sometimes always match up.
They're different, you know, and it's good and right, you know.
Yep.
That makes basically, that gives it a wealth, you know, to a country.
All right. Well, I wanted to talk about the dining scene. I mentioned that before we took a break. Are there any major changes that have happened in the last couple decades, maybe in the last 50 years? Because you know, your career started there. You worked. How long did you work in the industry there in Austria? Almost a couple decades?
Yeah.
Yeah. You got around. So yeah. You definitely have your kind of like finger on the pulse. What have you seen evolve over the last couple decades?
You know, it was interesting to see there's so much happening right now. And it's, we think obviously about Vienna, but right now there's almost more happening in Salzburg, the dining scene, even the surroundings. We see that, you know, French cuisine obviously, you know, exploded all over the world. We used certain elements, but we went back to our own produce. What we do very often over there, we're going to go to certain restaurants, you know, they harvest their own herbs, but they're going to even the mountainous herbs and utilizing that into the cuisine. They produce their own salt, all different types of salt. So they're going very, very detail-oriented.
Where is the salt coming from?
From Salzburg. Mm-hmm. They make that, but they make that, mix that with herbs. They make their own honey. They make everything themselves. That became quite a trend. If you go, for instance, to a restaurant in Vienna, Steyrek, which is one of my absolute favorites, they even get dried oranges from Schloss Schönbrunn, where basically the old emperor's residence was. And they dry that. It's phenomenal to see that.
How do they use that in dishes, or is it?
They dry that, mm-hmm. you know, with sugar, and let's just at the end, like a petit four, a light
okay.
one.
Okay.
But what's interesting about Austrian cuisine is we always see that, like German food, it's also there. It's very distinctly different. The best way to describe that to me is always on desserts, because desserts can be always very sweet, very rich, and very heavy. Germans have that, generally speaking. Now, you know, cuisine, generally speaking, in a mountainous area can be also heavier, like you mentioned before. But when you go a little bit, you have to, again, go back to the monarchy. When you go to the whole Bohemian component, we have a lot of influences in sweets there, especially. And that's what I compare. Very often people ask me, what's the difference to French pastry versus Austrian pastry? But that's an interesting question, because Marie Antoinette comes always back into the game there,
which influenced
the French very, very strong onto that. But without starting a political debate, is to me, the French use always a little bit more cream, use a little bit more butter. Mm-hmm. So that gets very often
a little bit richer.
Austrians maintained one thing, you have sweet, but still there's a certain lightness to it. They don't like that heaviness.
And what about, you mentioned the herb salt and honey and things like that. Are those products that are exported abroad or?
No, they make that themselves. There's one little restaurant that I love to go. It's just outside of Vienna. It's a 45-minute trip. For Austrians, it's a lot. For Americans, it's basically their daily commute. It's just for me, he produces everything himself, all the herbs. He goes harvesting himself into the forest, even the mushrooms, everything. It's amazing to see that. And it's when you walk in there, it's a very casual, very traditional restaurant.
And you talked a little bit about art in the first half, and what are maybe some of your favorite Austrian artists, writers, and is there any relationship between art and food there that you see play out?
Yes, I mean, yes, wherever is art, there's always music also on the side, because look, people who enjoy eating and drinking, they ultimately have also a cultural interest. That they have an eye for art is very simple, it comes very close. They have an eye also, an ear for music that comes very close. They love the beautiful things in life. That comes just one hand in hand. We see that in New York, the same thing. You know, New Yorkers are very artsy when you look into that.
Let's go back really quick to regional cuisines. I know we kind of were just finishing that up before the break. What is there one specific region? I know you mentioned you're more interested in Salzburg right now. You're more excited by it, I should say, than Vienna. What else? Are there any trends besides like local and maybe even wine trends? We can start getting there because we're going to run out of time. We still need to talk about wine.
There are regional slight differences. They are, without a doubt. But they're not as severe, because Austria is a rather small country, bear in mind, you know. I mean, New York State is much larger than Austria is.
Yes.
So much larger. But wine-wise, I think a lot of things happening there right now. I mean, Austria is really, really tiny. We make 1% of the entire world wine production. So that gives you a little idea. We export about 20 to 25%. The rest is consumed in Austria. We Austrians love our wine. It's a very drinkable wine. It might be not the most... Austrian wine is always known you can drink it very early. We like to do that, but it can age also incredibly well. It's just the Austrians were very thirsty in the begin with, so to keep something on the side, you find out it's harder to find older bottles. But when I get them, I buy them, and you know, they most of the times always incredibly interesting.
Well, let's get into that. In 2008, you partnered with an Austrian winemaker, Kakar, to produce Grüner Veltliner in the Weinviertel. Why did you choose Vine Virtual? Is it because you want to make wine there, or you want to work with that winemaker? How did that all happen?
Well, the idea to basically why I got into wine was because I came from a trip from Argentina, and I realized, because down there, the winemakers, they ask me so many questions, and what can you criticize about my wine? What can I do better? And then I come to realize on my way back, what am I doing? I criticize only. And that's, criticizing is easy. You don't have to know anything you can criticize. But I haven't made anything. And now, of course, I exposed myself into that by going making wine because, that's certainly a whole new challenge. But I always like challenges. I like difficulties to figure out and to resolve. And we went to Weinviertel, therefore, because we didn't want to go to Wachau, Kamtar, Kremstal, but the really more known areas for that and the more famous areas, even here in the States. Weinviertel was for something because we knew we could get old wines, or vineyards with old wines, and we knew also there's a lot of limestone soils there, which we are looking for just to have a certain freshness, because Gerhard loves white Burgundies. I love white Burgundies because I work with that at Le Barandin all the time. And so therefore we look for that freshness, and we knew we could make that there.
And the first vintage was 2009?
2009 was the first vintage.
11's on the market now?
The single vineyard, yes, because we created a second wine because 2010 was such a small in terms of yield. Mm-hmm. Vintage, we basically were down 70%. And I started.
Why? What happened?
It was cold. It was rather cold, and we lost a lot with frost. Mm. The quality is fantastic. I mean, I love the 2010s, even though we made 800 bottles of that wine. But whenever I see them, I buy them immediately up for myself because there was not much there in the first place. Then we created a second label called Vineyards from Lower Austria. And it's a much more easier accessible wine. We serve there currently the 2012. And with the single vineyard, we're always a year behind. Always like the type of Burgundy. Again, we release later. We leave the wine long on the lease.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk more about that with you, but we're running out of time. So we have to talk about Sambar. It opened earlier this fall. And I know I loved it. I had a great time. I love the ambiance, of course, the wine. I love the way the food came out, the little bites and some of the larger dishes as well. Ryan Sutton had very nice things to say on Eater this week about you guys. So
yeah,
it seems like it's going good. What do you think?
Well, with Ryan Sutton, we had pressure there without a doubt because he's a very respected reviewer. He can be a very tough reviewer. He's very driven, without a doubt. Very driven. No, the whole project, Alderson Wine Bar, is of course great because Maggie Lecros and Eric Huppert, they both came to me and said, look, you work so long with us, we like to do something with you and we like to reward you for your work too. And it's so far a great, great success, yeah, and it's fun.
You're having fun.
Yeah, it's so different, because Le Barandin is a 3-Michelin-star restaurant. It runs on its own way, and has its own thing. Alderson Wine Bar is a true wine bar. Look, it's not a restaurant. It's a wine bar. And it's for everybody. It's a whole new thing where we have to get our heads around because what we are known, what I was knew best was how to perform on a 3-Michelin-star restaurant. To work at wine bar is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, but that had to be really an interesting evolution and experience for you to kind of... And you've been with Le Barandin for, what, since 2007?
Yeah, 7.5 years now.
So, you've got to shake things up a bit and start new projects. You have lots of projects going on. So what's next? I mean, you've got wine, you have wine bars, you work with Zalto, I know. So come on, you're being kind of lazy. What's going to happen next year?
The day has only 24 hours. I experienced that lately. No, I mean, even Zalto. Look, Zalto is taking off beautifully. It's one of the top classes, without a doubt. We have the Alderson Wine Bar. People jump on it. Ryan Sutton mentioned it very, very strongly. Yes, that's an investment, without a doubt. But, we owe it to our customers to give them a great glass when you drink wine. And wine is, it's such an important thing. Like, I always compare that to a loudspeaker. Mm-hmm. You know, you can listen to great music from your, from the loudspeaker your grandfather gave to you, or you can listen to a brand new, you know, top of the line loudspeaker. You will experience much more from the same type of music. And the same is with the glass. And it's important to make people aware of that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. I could talk to you all day. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me here.
If you are in New York, make sure you go check out Soundbar at 151 West 51st Street. And I'd like to sign off today on a more personal note. This is the last episode of Season 1 here on Native, on Heritage Radio. It's been so wonderful learning about Ireland from Clodagh McKenna, China from Fuchsia Dunlop, Portugal from George Mendes, and so, so many more. You can find all of this season's episode on heritageradionetwork.com or on iTunes and Stitcher, or more on my website, briannakurtz.com. I'm already revving up for Season 2, and I'm heading over to Asia for the holidays to bring you all kinds of great food and travel shows for Season 2. You can follow along at BKFAF on Twitter and Instagram. And otherwise, happy holidays, happy new year, and I'll see you in 2015.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.